First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
The governor kicks off his presidential campaign on social media, but technical issues mar the launch. Good morning. We're live from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a rocky kickoff to Governor Ron DeSantis's presidential launch. We'll talk about that, but also the issues in this campaign. So give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, some ideas for your Memorial Day weekend from Create Jax later in the hour. But first this morning, the launch of the governor's presidential campaign on Twitter didn't quite go as planned. Technical issues messed up the official announcement with platform owner Elon Musk and billionaire David Sacks. Let's take a listen.
Good afternoon, good evening, or good morning, everyone, depending on wherever in the world you're joining us from. I'm broadcasting live from Twitter headquarters. It's David Sacks here. Elon is sitting next to me. And we want to welcome you to this historic Twitter Spaces event, and more broadly, a first in the history of social media. Tonight, I'm pleased to introduce two individuals who've done more to loosen the grip. All right, sorry about that. We've got so many people here that I think we are kind of melting the servers.
All right, great. So let's see.
So they just keep crashing, huh?
All right, I'd like to welcome Governor DeSantis for this historic.
We're just trying to get it going because there's so many people.
Well, once things did get underway on Twitter Spaces, the governor focused on the same culture war issues that he's been stressing here in Florida. We're going to discuss the launch and the issues with two great guests in studio now. Mike Binder, who leads the Public Opinion Research Lab at UNF. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
And also here in studio, Nick Seabrook, PhD as well, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration, also at UNF.
Good morning, Melissa.
And did you listen last night to the governor's announcement on Twitter with Elon Musk? Let us know your thoughts about the kickoff to the presidential campaign, what this means for Florida, who might get your vote next year. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Lots of tweets already coming in. We'll get to those in a bit. Facebook always open. All right. Mike Binder, let's begin with you. We actually edited down the audio from that launch to just hear the best bits because there were a lot of empty spaces and silence and film music and such. It was just not a good launch. Is that important, though? Does it matter in the long run for Ron DeSantis?
I mean, it's certainly amusing. And if you're an opponent of the governor, you can poke fun at him as the Trump campaign has done, and even the Biden campaign kind of swooped in and really said, hey, our link works. And it was a link to their donation site.
Yeah, right. I saw that.
So there's a lot of fun to be had about this. I don't know that it really fundamentally changes the dynamic of the race going forward. He spent some time on TV last night, and presumably he'll be doing more traditional campaigning throughout the rest of the summer.
Sure. 549-2937. Nick Seabrook, once they finally got the Twitter Spaces platform to work, Ron DeSantis really went culture war all the way down in this campaign launch.
He did. And I thought that the governor's performance, particularly during the Q&A portion of last night's event, was actually fairly strong. I thought he seemed poised. He had a grasp of the issues. He seemed articulate, certainly in contrast to both his opponent in this primary and the president. He's kind of younger. He's more composed in these spaces. But what was notable, I think, was the types of issues that he was talking about. The worst kept secret in Florida politics for the last 2 months has been the fact that Ron DeSantis is running for president. And we've seen Donald Trump treat him like a primary opponent and really hammer him on issues like Social Security, issues like Medicare, bringing up the governor's votes back when he was in Congress. And so I thought it was notable that none of those things were mentioned last night. There was no discussion of Social Security, no discussion of Medicare, no discussion of abortion, the war in Ukraine, no mention of Donald Trump, his opponent in this election. You could have been forgiven for thinking that he's already the nominee and he's now running against Joe Biden.
Yeah. Is that a smart strategy for Ron DeSantis to just ignore Donald Trump as he seeks the votes of GOP primary voters that are, according to the polling, still sticking with Trump, most of them?
Well, if you look back to 2016, when there was a wide and deep field of Republican candidates, they tried to essentially ignore him, and all to their peril. And ultimately, at some point, Ron DeSantis is going to have to go on the attack against Donald Trump. There's no two ways about it. And if he waits too long, it might be too late.
We saw that over and over again in 2016. On the debate stage, Marco Rubio, other candidates trying to go after Trump and failing. They just couldn't do it.
It's hard.
This is a voter base. That's what they respond to, ultimately. That sort of no-holds-barred, aggressive brawling, really, that we saw on the Republican side last time.
And that is something where that is Donald Trump's wheelhouse. You can put him on a stage. He's quick-witted. He's charismatic. You know, think what you want about him politically and personally. The guy is really good on stage and really good in this arena. And this is something different than most folks, he truly loves it. Like, it is in his blood. And you can see that, and it's authentic. And that's hard to manufacture, and voters see through the fakeness.
549-2937. Nick Seabrook, also, Ron DeSantis has to try to win votes from Republicans who see the growing legal peril former President Trump is in, the indictments, the investigations, the incontrovertible fact that he did lose the election in 2020, despite his false claims that he didn't. DeSantis has to try to win those voters over without pointing out any of that stuff.
Right. And it's especially challenging to take on a candidate like Donald Trump in a primary when the things that make him a weaker general election candidate, the fact that he tried to steal an election, the fact that he's been indicted on felony charges, the fact that he was recently found liable in a civil sexual assault trial, are all things that you can't really talk about if you're running against him in the Republican primary, because his base is entirely on board with that. And so we've seen Ron DeSantis take a few kind of shots at Donald Trump, but he really hasn't gone after him on any of these things because he can't do that. He alienates more voters in a GOP primary than he potentially wins over if he attacks Trump on those weak points. And so what I think he needs to do is that he has to go after Trump on policy, and he has to talk about some of the policies that voters care about. And this all wokeness all the time kind of strategy, I just don't think is going to be enough to make up the kind of gap that he's facing in the polls right now.
We've also seen Trump hammer DeSantis on a 6-week abortion ban in Florida. Is Ron DeSantis electable if he should become the Republican nominee for president after the 6-week abortion ban in the state of Florida?
But if you look around the country, it's not like Florida's the only one, right? South Carolina just passed one. Lots of states have this. This is, if you're looking at red states, this is now the norm in a post-Roe world. So I don't know that this makes him unelectable by any stretch of the imagination. I think getting through the primary is his biggest challenge. Once you get to the general, generally speaking, the R's fall in line, the D's fall in line. And historically, you're working with this very small group of maybe mobilizing some moderate voters that may or may not show up. That's a much different task than winning over a primary electorate with a sitting president or former president in a race.
I get that. But at the same time, I do think abortion is going to be a potent issue. And we've seen that in a number of special elections around the country. We saw that in Wisconsin in a Supreme Court race. Those races are normally decided by a point or two. The abortion rights candidate won by like 11 points. That's unheard of in a state like Wisconsin. We saw that in Kansas, where women came out in droves to codify the right to bodily autonomy in a special referendum. I just think that is a potent issue. And
find me a Republican in this race for president that isn't on the 6-week train.
Donald Trump.
I mean, he's the one that appointed the Supreme Court justices that made Roe in that vein that made that possible.
But that's why I find it so fascinating that he's now hitting DeSantis on that same law that DeSantis has passed.
And Donald Trump, because he's Donald Trump, he gets to have it both ways. He gets to both take the credit for appointing the Supreme Court justices that overturned Roe, but he can also get away with being wishy-washy on this issue and not taking a position and being inconsistent. That's not something Governor DeSantis can get away with. I thought it was notable at the end of the Twitter space last night, the governor encouraged people to go and look at his website, rondesantis.com. And I did so. And people are probably familiar with candidate websites. You go there, you look up where they stand on the issues. Ron DeSantis' website does not have an on the issues section. He is running for president while trying to conceal what he believes about things like abortion. And I just don't think that he can move forward. He would probably be a strong general election candidate against Joe Biden. Joe Biden is a weak incumbent, but getting over the hump, beating Donald Trump, is the major stumbling block, I think, in his way right now.
I think there's big irony in thinking about the issues that DeSantis focuses on. If you look to what he's done in Florida, particularly the last legislative session, it's way to the right on a ton of things. But a lot of his supporters nationally are much more moderate Republicans. And he has to balance kind of exposing who he is policy-wise with potentially alienating his current base of support. And that's a very difficult line to walk.
Well, folks, if you're just tuning in as we speak with Nick Seabrook and Mike Bender of UNF, did you try to tune in last night to the Twitter Spaces conversation, audio only, on that platform, as Governor DeSantis kicked off his presidential campaign with Twitter owner Elon Musk? The launch was marred by technical glitches, but the campaign is now officially off and running. Who will get your vote for president next year? What are your thoughts about the race? What are the issues that matter most to you? 549-2937. Call us up. Travis on the South Side. Hi, Travis.
Hey, Melissa. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah. So my initial thoughts was, yeah, it definitely had some glitches there in the first couple of minutes. It kind of reminded me of the Cybertruck unveiling when they threw the steel ball at the shatterproof glass and it shattered. Just kind of funny. I don't remember that, but go ahead. Deal.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it was another snafu. But I really don't think, the right's going to say, oh, well, look how many people were logged in. At one point, they were talking about 500,000, melting the servers. So the right's going to say, look how popular it was. That's why it crashed. And then the left's going to poke fun at it. But what really got me was, the day before, Elon was on the Wall Street Journal forum where he was talking, and basically he said, Twitter Spaces is a place where political candidates can now go and really be kind of raw and unscripted, and voters can really get to hear a candidate talk like a normal person, which excites me as an independent because, I think that we're all just kind of tired of the system, which pushes a political extreme for the primaries, and then you get these two extremes, and it's like, oh gosh, we have to vote for one of these people. Mm.
I hear you, Travis.
Yeah.
So who would get your vote then? Have you thought about that yet?
I mean, as of right now, I feel like it's the same as the last two elections. I really am not excited to vote for either party because, like I said, the candidates just seem to be to such political extremes. But what really disappointed me about DeSantis is he literally said that the night before, like, this is a place for candid speech and just to, have a raw conversation. And DeSantis comes out of the gate with a script. I mean, it was a totally scripted, speech the first, 10 minutes. And that was the most awkward part of the announcement to me.
Okay.
But,
yeah. I appreciate that, Travis. That's Travis on the South Side. Twitter Spaces is a niche kind of platform. I should disclose, in the wake of Donna Deegan becoming mayor of Jacksonville, I did a couple of these Twitter Spaces, and they were a much smaller group of people. Maybe 10 to 20 people were invited to join, and they ended up getting, a few hundred people listening. But the whole point of them, as he pointed out, is to just sort of have this free-flowing conversation. And that really wasn't what it was.
Well, I mean, I don't think you can have a launch for a presidential campaign with a free-flowing conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not what those things are designed for.
I think that's right. They're typically scripted and controlled to the nth degree. And Nick, I suppose they thought they could apply that model to this platform, and it just didn't work.
Well, particularly, I thought, as Travis was saying there, that the kind of 5-minute stump speech at the beginning of this from Governor DeSantis was by far the weakest part of this entire event. And he came across a lot better when he was answering questions. Now, admittedly, these are softball questions from a friendly audience. We had the likes of Representative Tom Massey, Dana Loesch, Chris Rufo teeing up pitches for him.
All strong supporters of the governor, yeah,
right.
Sure.
And it remains to be seen how he might perform under more aggressive or hostile questioning. But he was certainly much more impressive, I thought, when he was responding to those questions than he was at the beginning when he was delivering this kind of stuffy and stilted stump speech. That's really not his strength as a candidate.
Sure. I mean, this is a guy who's Ivy educated. He's no dummy. There's a long way to go in this campaign. DeSantis could certainly rebound after this rocky launch.
Sure. I mean, he is your Northeastern liberal elite, right? You know, Harvard educated, Yale. But this is, we are months away from votes being cast. We are far into this. Yes, we've been talking about it for a long time now, but we're going to be continuing to talk about it. And we'll talk about something new and exciting next week. I have no doubt.
And let me just always say, I so appreciate you guys being willing to come here to Studio 2 to talk about it and share your political insights. Our guests in studio right now, Mike Binder and Nick Seabrook of UNF, and you. Did you listen to the governor's Twitter launch last night? What are the issues that matter most to you as we all vote for president next year? Yeah, it's a long way off, but hey, it's Florida, so we always like to talk politics. 549-2937, Jason in San Marco. Hi, Jason. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I hope you can hear me. I'm on my Bluetooth.
All right, we got you, Jason. Go ahead.
Wonderful. So I have two comments. One, I may be missing something, but I think you pointed out that in Kansas, they voted when actual abortion rights were actually on a ballot. They voted to preserve them. The in-studio guest
overwhelmingly,
sort of applying,
overwhelmingly.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is that where laws have been passed, it's been primarily old white Republican men simply passing a law without actually consulting their constituents. And then I want to say one more thing. I've got a nickname for Donald Trump, and it's user-friendly. He's labeled everybody he's ever gone up against, and for some reason, his opponents are afraid to label him. But here you go. Call him Don the Con, and it works two ways. He's Don the Convict, and he's Don the Con Man, and everyone in America can remember Don the Con. And if his opponents would start using this on a regular basis, it would be stuck to him like white on rice, as we say, and it would be a very useful reminder that this man has been convicted, or he's about to be, and that he is a proven con man. I mean, the $25 million payment that went to the Trump University class action lawsuit is really all the evidence you need. Again, thank you, Melissa, and have a great day.
Okay, Jason, thanks. You know, I think, Mike, you might have been the one that touched on this. None of these Republican primary candidates for president are going to come out with a childish, immature, yet catchy, derogatory nickname for Donald Trump. Yet he's going to come up with one for all of them.
I mean,
he already has.
DeSantis is on like his fourth or fifth iteration of catchy nicknames. They just haven't stuck yet.
I mean, but what about that? Like that, our politics is now pro wrestling. I for one, am not happy about that. But that's the reality of where we are today.
And we've seen this going back all the way to 2016. That, to coin another nickname, Teflon Don.
Yeah,
he can get away with anything. Everything slides off of him. He can do things that no other political figure can do. And he can get away with it. But the caller touched on the issue of abortion there. And I think this is really going to be central for the general election. The reason why Democrats did as well as they did in 2022, in special elections, it was because of abortion. It was because women voters in swing states and swing districts turned out to vote for Democrats, even in a year where the fundamentals were against them.
100%. And I do maintain, I think that will remain a potent issue next year. I think people might be underestimating that. Okay, lots of tweets. Tony tweets the show, DeSantis is the number two. He's just there in case Trump's legal problems have him drop out of the election. If Donald Trump is staring down the barrel of multiple indictments 6-8 months from now, does this calculus change?
No.
That's a short answer.
Yeah, there's no way. Donald Trump is not dropping out of this race. He might not win this race, but he's not dropping out. And he could be in Rikers Island in an orange jumpsuit and handcuffs, and he'd still be running.
People have run for president from prison in this country. They didn't win, but but you can run for president from prison.
Yeah,
disallowed from that.
And it's not unclear that he wouldn't be able to pardon himself upon being inaugurated.
Let us know your thoughts, folks. 549-2937, Ed in Orange Park. Good morning, Ed.
Yes, hi. Yeah, just a couple of things. As far as the glitches that happened, somehow I don't think even the Democrats believe that if it would have been Biden getting interviewed, you're going to have any type of problem because too many millions of people are trying to click in and listen to the president. As far as any of the votes brought up by when he was a congressman, meaning, of course, DeSantis, that was all brought up already many times by both his the Republicans he ran against in different primaries, and also, of course, by the Democrats, including Chris. And it resulted on a landslide, historic proportion with 19 points. So that's not going to work too well. Now, the governor is correct, I hope, for him to try as much as possible to follow Ronald Reagan's 11th Commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican. It puts him above the fray. It makes it look much more dignified. As far as the abortion question, well, the governor probably is going to he's a constitutionalist. The Supreme Court has decided that each state can do pretty much whatever they want to. So you can have an example, California and other more blue states who literally have pretty much abortion allowed for any reason, literally to an hour before birth.
That's not true. That's not true.
I mean, I don't see there's anything. In other words,
I hear your point, but you are not allowed to have abortion on demand up to an hour before birth unless the mother is on the point of dying. That's just not true. That's not true.
Well, I mean, unless there's a legal process that stops it, there's no limit, and that is constitutional according to the Supreme Court. You know, each state can do whatever they want to, one way or the other way, and that is perfectly legal. And please tell me if I'm incorrect on that.
No, what I'm saying is that there are states with more access to abortion, but you are not allowed to have an abortion right before the baby is born way you're describing in California. But listen, let me get some more calls on it. May on the South Side. Go ahead.
Hello, how are you guys doing this morning?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm gonna take it up with. I was listening to some of the name calling and stuff, and one thing I loved about Donna Deegan's campaign and about Joe Biden's presidential campaign is the Democrats did not stoop to the name calling, and as funny and all that it seems right now, we're above that. We need to deal with issues, and we have certainly enough in Florida to deal with without jumping on the bandwagon train. So that's all I have to say about that. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Nick Seabrook, a lot to unpack from those two callers. Your thoughts?
Well, I think going back to the point that was made by the first caller there, being above the fray, being the candidate who talks about issues, who doesn't go on the attack against their opponents, that's a strategy that can work, but it's a strategy that only works if you're the front runner. It's a strategy that works well if you're up 30 points in the polls rather than down 30 points in the polls. And he brought up the fact that all of these questions about DeSantis's voting record on things like Social Security, Medicare, entitlement plans have been raised. And the reason they keep coming up is that he has not had a satisfactory answer as to what his positions now are on these issues, what he will do as president when it comes to entitlements, when it comes to abortion. And so,
by the way, just to double check the law in California, it's legal until what doctors call viability, around 24 weeks, when the fetus can survive outside the womb, which is the standard in many states where it's legal. Go ahead.
And was the standard in Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that it was protected up to viability. But I'll
Mike Binder.
Let Mike respond now.
Well, I mean, I think the trick is, speaking about DeSantis and his policies and where he sits on these issues, right? He was asked on Fox News last night twice about Medicare and Social Security and simply ignored it and didn't say a word because he probably doesn't have a great answer for that, right? You can't deal with debt in this country and not address half of the federal budget. The other thing on abortion is, you know, it's not clear to me that Ron DeSantis is on board with the state-by-state policy going forward. I would imagine in these Republican primaries, many candidates are going to come out with a nationwide push that this argument should be a national thing because they're saving lives in their eyes. And saving lives in Florida or Texas or South Carolina is simply not enough. They need to save all the lives. And I would fully expect a push for a nationwide six-week ban.
John in San Marco. Hi, John.
Good morning, Melissa. Your laugh is gold. That's always what makes me call in.
Okay, great. What are your thoughts?
Well, quickly, and then you can talk. I want to express condolences to the Davis, the Daniel Davis and Fussell families that had a death in their family just a couple of days after the election. And with Madam Deegan in mind, did either DeSantis or Trump or did the person that endorsed her win?
I'm sorry, which person are you talking about?
DeSantis and Trump.
Well,
I didn't know if they had endorsed Donna.
No. Neither of them endorsed Donna Deegan, although the governor endorsed Daniel Davis. Thank you, John. And by the way, you know, Deegan, part of the reason she won was this sort of bipartisan appeal and some Republican endorsements. That's a different kind of kettle of fish, because I think that campaign turned much more on local issues. But before we say goodbye, guys, you know, the governor was able to get the legislature to change the law in Florida, this sort of resign to run law. He no longer has to resign as governor to run for president. He's had a compliant legislature. Now he's going to be flying all over the country for the next year or so running for president. There are still a lot of issues in Florida that the legislature and the governor are being hammered on, in particular housing affordability, property insurance, kitchen table issues. Those are still real issues here.
Yeah, and I would imagine that over the course of the next legislative session, which is going to be an early legislative session next year, starting in January, that the governor is going to take a much smaller role than he did this past year. And I would expect us to kind of devolve back to maybe the more recent history of intra-party fighting within the two houses as more the kind of what we're looking forward to.
Mm-hmm. Nick Seabrook.
Well, I do think this is one area where the governor can make a strong contrast between himself and Donald Trump on the issue of competence, on the issue of executive and bureaucratic experience. He talked a lot about how he delivers results, how he gets things done. And that's certainly the case. And that was one of the greatest weaknesses of the Trump administration, that Trump had a lot of rhetoric, he had a lot of ideas, but he really had difficulty getting things moving through the federal bureaucracy because he didn't hire the right people. He brought in people from the business world, people with backgrounds like him, not people with executive or governmental experience. That is an area, I think, where Ron DeSantis can legitimately say, I will get more done as president with the federal bureaucracy than Donald Trump was or will be able to do. And he certainly hammered on that theme quite a bit last night.
Is that something, though, that Republican primary voters, is that at the top of their issue list?
I don't think it's at the top of their issue list. But I think it's something that he can use to his benefit to some extent.
All right. Well, thank you, Nick Seabrook. He's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNF. And also at UNF, Mike Bender, who leads the nationally regarded public opinion research lab, the polling lab there. So, guys, always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you so much. And much more still ahead. Later, Create Jack steps by with some great ideas for your Memorial Day holiday. But up next.
I think the most disturbing thing that I found is that the dogs that they, Canine for Warriors, are providing are not true service dogs.
New questions about one popular veterans charity. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville City Councilman Rory Diamond recently stepped down from his $300,000 a year salaried position as head of the local nonprofit Canines for Warriors. The charity is known for matching service dogs to veterans as a treatment for PTSD. Diamond is currently on an overseas deployment. He did respond to WJCT News, though, to strongly refute allegations that have been made against his prior leadership of Canines for Warriors. In a new article published at the Florida Center for Government Accountability, journalist Susan Clark Armstrong spoke with veterans who alleged they were provided with aggressive and poorly trained dogs through the charity. She also found evidence of Diamond racking up personal expenses on the charity's credit card. For the record, Diamond says all expenses were approved and vetted by the nonprofit's board. Again, he no longer leads the organization. I spoke with reporter Armstrong about Canines for Warriors. Here's that conversation.
Hi, Susan. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've published this piece at the Florida Center for Government Accountability about Rory Diamond's tenure as CEO of Canines for Warriors, the nonprofit that has gotten a lot of plaudits for helping military veterans with PTSD by providing the service dogs. Mm-hmm. This piece alleges problems inside Canines for Warriors under Diamond's leadership. What did you find out?
I interviewed, as you said, quite a few people, and I think the most disturbing thing that I found is that the dogs that they, Canines for Warriors, are providing are not true service dogs. I think to understand the egregious nature of what's going on at Canines, you kind of have to understand what a service dog, a real service dog, psychiatric service dog does. And those dogs should be trained to assist veterans with, of course, PTSD. And I think we need to look and see to determine what they actually are supposed to do. They're supposed to help veterans, critically ill veterans, with all aspects of their disability. The dogs that Canines are providing, according to my sources, and there's many of them, they are not psychiatric service dogs.
And how were you able to ascertain that?
I spoke with trainers. I spoke with volunteers, and a lot of veterans who obtained these dogs, and the things that the dogs are supposed to be doing and to help the veterans. These dogs are not trained to do that. They've also been given dogs that were sick and too small for the task. These are working dogs. They provide all sorts of things for the warriors. They should be trained to turn on lights when the warrior has a bad dream, to provide to get the medication for them, and to sense when a warrior is or a veteran gets anxious, and to do this this thing it's called My Lap, to get in the veteran's lap. And there's just so many tasks that a psychiatric service dog is supposed to be trained to do that these dogs do not do. The veterans say this, the trainers say this, employees, volunteers. There's been plenty of comments online and in person about the downfalls of the dogs that canines are training. And the training is supposed to be at least for 9 months. And the training allegedly at canines is usually around 12 weeks.
Okay. You know, we reached out to Jacksonville City Councilman Rory Diamond about this allegation and others made in the article. He calls the publication as stemming from, in his words, an obscure left-wing website and a hit piece that Councilman Diamond says is littered with falsehoods and innuendos. And I quote directly from his statement. He says, the suggestion that Canines for Warriors is producing inferior dogs is false. Every service dog agency has dogs returned, and the return rate for canines is well in line with other national organizations. This is incredible given that Canines primarily uses rescue dogs. So what's your response to Diamond's statement on the quality of the dogs his organization was matching up with veterans?
Well, first let me address his contention that we are an obscure left-wing website. I guess Mr. Diamond does not realize that I am a right-wing, conservative, gun-toting, Christian, Catholic, Republican, and I did vote for Governor DeSantis. His contention that they're not giving dogs, inferior dogs, is that's his contention. I read his statement, and even if I were a bad shot, I could blow holes in every paragraph that he wrote. All you have to do is talk with the veterans, talk with the volunteers, all the employees there, and look at the quality of the dogs that they're receiving and have returned. And you can very well understand that Canine is not fulfilling their mission.
Let me ask you as well about some other aspects of Diamond's tenure at Canines for Warriors. You claim, after speaking to people affiliated with the organization, that there were allegations of operational and financial problems at Canines. What did you discover there?
First of all, Canines, Patty Dotson, who is the attorney and the second in command at Canines, was not very willing to share public records with me. But volunteers and former employees helped me to get some records. I obtained records, his credit card receipts, from January 1st, 2019, to September of 2019. He stated that that his expenses were always independently reviewed, but actually they were not. What he did is he provided missing receipt affidavits, and in that affidavit he said that all the expenses that he incurred were defined by company policy and procedures as being allowable. He also said that he exhausted all methods of obtaining a copy of the receipts. Mr. Diamond did have a problem obtaining receipts, which is why he had to do the missing receipt affidavits. But I don't see how that a person can go to a hotel, a very expensive hotel, and run up very large expenses and not be able to get a receipt. It appeared that every bit of his the gasoline that he bought for his privately owned vehicle was charged to Canine. There were meals that he ate by himself that he said were business related.
And you've been able to document that?
I have that documented, absolutely.
Where is that documented? Where you can trace the flow of money?
Yeah, I have it documented in his credit card receipts.
Let me ask you about his response to these allegations. He says,
"Okay,
this is from Diamond. He says, while I typically ignore false claims online to protect Canines for Warriors, please note the following. I did not have the authority to approve my expenses at Canines. The organization has strong internal controls to ensure every penny is spent wisely." He goes on to say that his expense reports were always independently reviewed and that any expense that could be seen as even slightly personal in nature was paid for by him, Rory Diamond. What about that?
I have not seen all of his expenses. I have seen his credit card expenditures for those 9 months. And if you look at those receipts or the credit card statement, it appeared that Rory Diamond was having a really good time on Canine's Dime. The information is right there for anybody to review.
And did you decide to look into the leadership at Canines for Warriors just based on conversations with veterans that had been trying to work with the service dogs? What prompted you to write the article and do the investigation?
A woman named Emily Nunez contacted me about November of 2021. She has a financial background. She said that she had looked at some of the 990s and some of the financial reports about Canine, and there was some disturbing things going on. She asked me to look at them, and I did, and agreed with her. So she had done so much research already, and she wanted me to write the story, but I told her that since she had worked so hard that she should write it and that I would help her write it. That story came out. She looked at the finances. I looked at Mr. Rory's, Mr. Diamond's, his resume, or his imaginative resume. And so the story came out in Folio in March of 2022. After that story came out, there were veterans and volunteers and other employees and, of course, the trainers just inundated her with information saying that that was just the tip of the iceberg.
But let me point out as well that Rory Diamond has left the position as head of Canines for Warriors, has actually deployed overseas. And so what about where this organization goes from here?
According to the employees and the veterans that I've spoken with, there's not anybody at Canines now in upper management that can turn this organization around. They have suggested to me that, of course, the everybody who comes to Canines, whether they're an employee or a veteran or a volunteer, they have to sign non-disclosure agreements. These people have told me that if they were released from their NDAs, that they would talk with the board of directors and they would help them reestablish this the original mission of Canines for Warriors, because they all believe in the mission. They just do not believe in the people who say they're fulfilling that mission.
Well, Susan Clark Armstrong, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And in a moment, some ideas for your Memorial Day weekend from CreateX. We'll be right back.
WinGuard, a local marketing and communications agency that develops websites designed to attract and engage customers. Launching or refreshing a website can give local companies an edge over their competition. Now celebrating its 15th year, WinGuard is proudly located in Five Points and serves client partners across Northeast Florida. More information on WinGuard's website design and development services can be found at wearewinguard.com.
Next time on The World, Japan plans to release more than 1 million tons of nuclear waste into the ocean. Many Pacific Islanders strongly disapprove.
It opposes our worldview that people should live in harmony with the environment and the ocean.
Also a reminder of the long and painful history of nuclear testing in the Pacific. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Deepa Fernandez. Native American boarding schools sought to erase Native language and culture with harsh punishment.
We have to remember when we think about the abuse, this was cultural genocide, which elicited deep harm and deep trauma, and trauma is a really complex thing.
The legacy of those schools and one community's quest for accountability and healing, that's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
He brought the animal rights movement to the forefront 50 years ago, and his writing on factory farming changed lives and diets. Author and philosopher Peter Singer is now back with an update called Animal Liberation Now. Singer tells us how he thinks animal rights have improved and why here in the U.S. there's much more to do. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's time to talk about the weekend. And this isn't just any weekend. It's Memorial Day weekend. What are your plans? Create Jacks always puts together a great curated list for all of our listeners. And they call it The Move. Catalina Selvain is here to get us moving. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you.
Same as always. It's a very, very busy weekend.
Oh, there's so much on your list this week. Okay, today's Thursday. You're going to kick things off with stuff happening Friday through Sunday. What's caught your eye?
Most of Jazz Fest, obviously, which we will get to. But Friday, we can start maybe a little slower. This will be the opening reception of Earthly Matters, an exhibit by Beau Bartlett at MoCA. And Bartlett is known for his large-scale paintings that explore American life and cultural heritage. So mm-hmm. Earthly Matters is presenting some of his works that explore human impact and interaction with the natural world. Mm-hmm. So the subjects in this art are finding themselves in precarious environmental situations, either from their own doing or forces beyond their control. And Bartlett, the way that these large-scale scenes are done is meant to bring in the viewer to almost contemplate their role in that narrative. So that'll be really interesting. That's Friday night at MoCA.
And that's free.
It is free. Open to everybody.
Check that out, folks. And while you're downtown, of course, visit one of multiple stages set up for the Jacksonville Jazz Festival. Always a Memorial Day weekend highlight.
I love how many people come to Jacksonville for this, but I also get so nervous because there are so many people driving down the wrong way on a one-way street. As police remember
maybe
to look
the
at
new
the
mayor,
sign.
Donna Deegan, can get finally get rid of the one-way streets downtown. Mayor Deegan, if you're listening, let's make this happen. I mean, multiple administrations have said they're going to tackle that, and they never do. So.
I think my biggest fear is just, please, for Jazz Fest weekend, make sure you're driving down the right way on a one-way street.
Yes.
And hopefully on the way to Jazz Fest after dark. Because while, yes, there is so much great stuff going on with Jazz Fest programming, the party does not stop after that night's headliner. And, I mean, any bar you walk into, any venue downtown will have something going on. Like Friday night, Raisin Cake Orchestra will be at Breezy Jazz House in San Marco. Now, that's a $30 ticket, but it's very much worth the money. And DJ Papi Disco will be at Underbelly. So wherever you go, there will be a party after dark all Jazz Fest weekend.
Yeah, you've got stuff listed at 1904 Music Hall, at Justice Pub.
Yes.
And then for the Jazz Fest itself, things kick off tonight at the Florida Theater with a piano competition. Friday, you've got local favorites, LPT.
Love them.
Or excuse me, they're on Saturday. LPT and Ulysses Owens Jr. performing Saturday night, all along with Chaka Khan.
What
Chaka
a legend.
Khan. Chaka Khan.
Chaka Khan.
I know. She's performing downtown, David Sanborn on Sunday, and a lot of other great artists. So all of that at the Jazz Fest website. All right. So that's this weekend. Let's look ahead to next weekend. On June 3rd, it's the kickoff of Jacksonville's Blue Zones initiative at the fairgrounds.
Yes, and this is definitely something worth checking out because this is something new to Jacksonville. So this is their intro to the city. David Butner is the founder of Blue Zones, and he's a National Geographic Fellow, and he's discovered 5 places in the world that he's dubbed Blue Zones where people live the longest and are the healthiest. And this is from Japan to Italy to Costa Rica, Greece, and one city, Loma Linda in California. So his team of demographers found that there are 9 specific lifestyle habits in these areas. And this is all being shared with us, that Blue Zones is coming to Jacksonville. And this is their free community-wide well-being event where there will be live demonstrations, food trucks, activities, with the whole goal of nudging our neighbors and ourselves towards a better well life. And there's going to be music, great music all day from DJ Nick Fresh. You can rock out with the Jaguars D-Line. And there'll also be, you know, some nutritious snacks, breath work, just a lot of good stuff to help us be a little more in those Blue Zones.
That is next Saturday, June 3rd, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the fairgrounds, and it's free.
It is free.
Okay. Also next Saturday, ooh, a crawfish festival at James Weldon Johnson Park.
Oh, yeah. We love to eat good in this city, for sure. And Jag Boilers will be serving up the best crawfish in Jacksonville, along with some other food trucks for you to explore and snack at. Got some cold treats with other food trucks. And, of course, desserts, because what's the point of eating if you can't have a little something sweet at the end of it?
Yeah.
And there will also be a kids zone. So this will be a day for the whole family from 11 to 8, James Weldon Johnson Park.
Last but not least, Saturday, June 3rd, it's a Goodwill Festival at the beaches. Seawalk Pavilion.
Yeah, so this is a really big party at the Seawalk Pavilion where active military and veterans are coming together to thank the communities for their support. This is such a big military town. You know, thank you for your service is something we hear many times throughout every single day. So this is sort of reversed where where active military members and veterans are able to thank us for the community support. So
yeah,
this will feature lots of music, food, even resources for the community, and thousands of families are expected to participate in this day.
Well, there's a lot more at createjax.com. That's createjax with the number 8. Look at their curated list of fun events. Catalina Salvain, you're simply the best.
Oh, thank you so much.
Better than all the rest. In fact, you're better than anyone I've ever met.
I feel like I've heard this before.
You have. R.I.P. to the Queen of Rock, the late Tina Turner. And have a great day, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.